Okay, let's get going. Welcome, everybody. I see a few new faces in here. Everybody's welcome. Can't believe it's the seventh week of the quarter already, so only three more weeks to go. So are there any questions from previous lectures, anything people had on their mind that want to ask me? Probably not. So today I want to talk a little bit about failure. How many have had a lecture on failure at Stanford? So this is the first time anybody's heard about failure. Failure is pretty important. But is it always a negative thing? Is it always something to avoid? Are some failures better than others? Is failure the opposite of success? These are some of the things I want to bring up today. So everybody knows about sayings that if you don't succeed, try again. And this is the mode where success is the opposite of failure. But there's a lesser known corollary that you may not be aware of. If first you don't succeed, don't take up skydiving, because if you only have one chance and you fail, you're going to be in big trouble. But actually, when you think about the saying, it brings out something. It says, if at first you don't succeed, try again. And what that means to me is that there's not just one event that's success or failure. There's multiple events. It's like in war, where there's lots of battles. A lot of battles make up a war. And if you're doing something, and you could have a lot of failures and successes mixed in. So, but you can learn a lot about failure and success from what people have said about it. And everybody knows about this. Failure is not an option. And that was Apollo 13, right? Why was failure not an option for Apollo 13? There's three reasons. Walter, do you know one? People's lives were at stake. What else was at stake? No. There was national prestige at stake, and everybody was watching us, watching the astronauts and the whole program. And if we had such a public failure, that would be bad news, right? But the opposite of that, I've seen, failure is always an option. When you try everything, you know, you can either have success or failure. And Adam Savage from MythBusters says that, and you can buy a T-shirt with that on it as well. So those are the two options: failure and success.
That's the third reason.
What?
I don't know.
Oh no, it was national prestige, and also the prestige of engineering and NASA itself. Sort of related, but different. And this saying was credited to Mary Pickford, an actress back in the 20s or 30s. And failure is not falling down; it's not getting up again. And this saying has actually been used by people with disability to, you know, talk about the success and failures that they have in their life, and also about, you know, if you fall off a horse, you know, you get back up again. So again, you have this notion here of one event and the possibility of another event. You know, you fall down now, but you have an opportunity, you know, to get up again. So it's more than just one event. In fact, there could be thousands of events. Thomas Edison says, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that did not work." So this is the ultimate amount of failures before success. And you would think that he would say, you know, I'm getting all these failures, and maybe there's something I don't understand about this process. And he would go back to the science a little bit and try to figure out, you know, something that would give him a better understanding of how to succeed. John, do you have a...
That's
correct. So the question I have, when he finally got it right, do you think a light bulb went off above his head? Thomas Watson said, if you want to increase your success rate, double your failure rate. So what does that mean? He says, don't be discouraged by failure. You can learn from it. Go ahead and make mistakes. Make as many as you want, because that's where you'll find success, on the far side of failure. So you have to try. You have to try multiple times, and a lot of times you're going to fail before you succeed. And who knows who Thomas J. Watson is besides you? Who knows who Thomas Watson is? Famous guy. And maybe the think sign could give you a hint. Yes. But you knew that already. Oh, you guessed? Okay, good.
I took a risk there.
Okay, and you succeeded. There's other people who have enunciated the same notion. Accept failure and learn from it. Consider failing as a blessing in disguise. Failure has the potential of harnessing one of the most powerful success forces. Failure should be our teacher, not our undertaker. Failure is delay, not defeat. It's a temporary detour, not a dead end. From failure can come valuable experience. So these are all sort of interesting sayings, and they all make sense. In fact, one of our founding fathers said, failure to prepare is preparing to fail. And what does that mean? You know, in my mind, is that if you're undergoing an endeavor, you know, you should consider failure as part of as a possible outcome. And you should prepare for that, have contingencies. So we go from a saying from our founding father to the saying of our cartoon father, trying is the first step towards failure. Well, you know, obviously if you don't try even once, you're not going to fail. Of course, you're not going to succeed either, but so you have to try, and sometimes you have to try a lot before you succeed. And Professor Peach has all his students say, embrace failure. So failure is a good thing if it's followed by success, ultimately. In fact, John Keats said, failure is the highway to success. So you're going down the road. You might have a few successes and failures, and hopefully you're learning something along the way to get to the point where you have success. In fact, maybe the only pathway to success is through all these failures. You got that? So what can we learn from all these things? And this is especially for people who are working on projects. And so the idea is to prototype early and often make lots of mistakes and failures. Use sketches, models, cardboard aided design, which is the original CAD nomenclature. You want as an engineer to employ all your knowledge and senses and skills and your tuition. Maybe as a student you don't have that quite built up yet, but this is all part of the process. So if you're building something, build something in your mind on paper, out of foam core, you know, whatever, to get all your senses that come into play. For people working on projects, you have a bunch of resources that you can take advantage of. Your team members, coaches, resource people, professors, anybody that can give you some information. It's very important to manage your time, because time is the one thing that is constant. You can't create more time. So you have to balance, you know, your fabrication, you know, the amount of time you're prototyping versus the amount of time you're thinking about things. So manage your time. Again, you have to expect that you're going to be making mistakes and you're going to have failures. And important thing is to understand them, learn from them, so the next time you do something, you won't have those failures again. And of course, don't get discouraged and don't give up. Because if the last thing you did was didn't succeed. So let's have a little discussion. Was Apollo 13 a success or a failure? Elaine?
I don't know which one crashed. I guess that must have been the
success. Yeah. What do you think? Right. Was there a Apollo 14 after that? Apollo 15? Were there flights after that?
Yeah, but they did the same thing that they were.
So
the failure was in engineering on the
thermal. Right. But did they obviously knew that could be a problem and they fixed it, right? Okay. So they fixed it and they had subsequent flights, right? Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So they had a lot of people working on the problem and they were able to come up with a solution to solve that one.
Yeah.
So they might not have landed on the moon, but it's sort of important to get the people back home. And the fact that they had subsequent flights that went okay, what does that say? That they were on, they learned, right. So would you say ultimately it was a success or failure? They had subsequent flights that were successful, right?
It's all part of the design process, isn't it?
Right. Okay, well, I would say it's a success because they solved the problem and they had other flights that were successful. But, okay, let's look at another example. How about the Concorde? And there's a picture of it taking off on its last flight.
What's in the last flight is a failure.
And do they have any flights after that?
No.
No. Right. And the failure wasn't even a part of the plane. It sucked up some material from the runway. So it's not that there was a problem with the plane. It was a problem with the runway. But the fact that they had no more flights after that meant that the last thing you heard of a Concorde is that it crashed. So I would say that's a failure. So what ultimately determines success or failure? I would say if people learn from it and they continued, you know, working on things. You know, if you're working on a project and you say, okay, I can't get the software to work, I give up. It's a failure. But if you say, I can't get this software to work, but I'm going to sleep on it and maybe tomorrow I'll have a solution and you figure it out, then it's a success. So it's the last thing that you do that determines whether it's success or failure in my mind. Okay? So can an effort be a partial success or partial failure? Say yes.
So most of these things weren't technically successes, but totally failures. The couple of their team would think of it as a success. I guess we discussed it as a success.
Right.
But these people could have died and if they didn't have that thing.
Okay. All right. I mean, I think this is sort of up to history, maybe. Okay. Thank you for the discussion. Do you see how it ties in with working on projects and stuff? That's the point I was trying to make about all this. Okay. So Thursday, we're going to have Ralph Hotchkiss here, and he's a fellow from Berkeley who, for many years, has done wheelchair fabrication in developing countries. So he goes to these countries and works with people there and designs wheelchairs from the parts and the materials that are available on site, like bicycle parts, and he works with people who do bicycle repair and welding and stuff like that. And this is... Of course, all these lectures I think are great, but Ralph is not around very often, and I think it's going to be a great lecture. But today we have Walter Greenleaf, And if you looked at the website, you see that he's got a lot of stuff on his bio, and I'm not going to read it all. Maybe that's from a few years ago. But I've known Walter for many years now. We're trying to figure out. Can't even remember when it was. It was that long ago. But it's suffice to say, Walter has been a pioneer in virtual reality and using virtual reality in rehabilitation. So I want to introduce him and get him going. His talk is going to be entitled "Virtual Reality Applications in Assistive Technology and Rehabilitation." So, Walter, let me transfer the microphone over to you. Okay.
Well, Dave didn't tell me he was going to precede this with a discussion about failure. And I think there's an irony there, because you'll see when I bring up my slides that part of my talk is about failure. And it's about the failure of this technology at this time to do what we thought it would do, and why that's been useful. So, Dave, there's a nice unplanned synergy there.
Okay. Forward.
Okay.
And here's your laser pointer.
Okay. I'm equipped.
Here's your water.
All right. Also, my colleague, Dr. Ivana Steigman, is going to talk about a part of the talk where we talk about cognitive therapy and cognitive rehabilitation. Ivana will help with. So, personal journey of frustration. But now that I've heard Dave define failure as part of the process, maybe I should revise this slide. Actually, it started, back in 1984, just a mile, less than a mile, a few minutes walk from here in front of the old anatomy building where I was a grad student. And I had this crazy friend named Jaron Lanier. We were both grad students living in garages. He lived in a garage in Menlo Park. No, I lived in a garage in Menlo Park. He was in Palo Alto. And I was working as a psychophysiologist, studying hormones and behavior. And I got very interested in virtual reality technology. Actually, Jaron was someone who was a programmer at Atari. He got very interested in making non-competitive games where you would use a virtual environment to make music. So, for example, he took a data glove that he designed along with a friend and used it to make gestures to produce music. Well, he, back in 1987, built one of the first commercial VR systems. It cost about $300,000 or more. The head mounted display that people were using was as heavy as a brick. And, in fact, you had to have a brick at the back of it to counterbalance it. But he coined the phrase virtual reality and started, which might have been a mistake actually, started this whole movement of thinking about how virtual reality technology could be useful for people in various parts of commerce and entertainment. And I got particularly excited about how it could be used for disability solutions. So I got together with Harry Murphy, a gentleman who pioneered the original CSUN conferences on technology for disabilities, and we organized a series of conferences back in the early 90s, this is from 1992, on virtual reality technology and persons with disabilities. Papers were published. There was a lot of hue and cry about how this emerging technology could be used to as a disability solution. And I'm sad to say right now that there hasn't yet been a lot of success. You can't go out there and purchase a VR system right now to function as a disability solution. There's been a lot of success in the laboratory. There's a lot of great examples of how this technology could potentially be used in this area. But as a augmentative technology, nothing really has come through yet. And I'll go through where there have been successes in terms of rehabilitation and therapy, and where I think there will be breakthrough successes as a commercially available disability solution. But like David said, it can be a long process to go through this. I don't know if you're familiar with this technology curve, but it's an analysis that some market research groups do about the evolution of technology. And they have a heuristic as to how they like to look at the evolution of technology over time. And Dave, has your group covered this at all before?
No.
Okay, well, the way they break it down is technology trigger, when a technology is first discovered or invented or prototyped, peak of inflated expectations, trough of disillusionment, the slope of enlightenment, and the plateau of productivity. And it's a remarkable pattern that a lot of emerging technologies go through. And you can map it out, and the symbols here, you probably can't see in the back of the room, but the triangles mean more than 10 years before it will actually become out there and useful as productive technology. 5 to 10 years are the blue dots. 2 to 5 years is the blue dots, and less than 2 years are the white dots. And virtual reality technology, starting back when Jaren first started to commercialize this technology, went through an extreme amount of hype. It was in Rolling Stone magazine. It was talked about in The Economist. There were movies made about it. Some very bad movies were made about it. Everybody got very excited about it, and who wouldn't? I mean, the idea that you could step into a computer-generated world and immerse yourself in it and interact with it, and that we'd be able to do it. And there were some, you know, commercial endeavors in terms of making low-cost data gloves and low-cost head-mounted displays. Nothing really got started off at the very beginning in terms of meeting those expectations. And then there was a pretty severe trough of disillusionment. But finally now, the technology has gotten to the point where it's affordable, where you can use Second Life, you can use some of the other emerging virtual reality platforms, you can actually do something with it. So one of the things I'm hoping is all the excitement we had back in the 80s and 90s about how virtual reality could be used to help people with disabilities, I hope we'll recapture that excitement, and maybe some of the people in this room will talk further with my group and some of the other groups out there. And there still are some great opportunities of using this technology and harnessing it to help as a disability solution. I would say right now, and this research group agrees with me, they say virtual world technology right now is just at the end of the trough of disillusionment and starting to go up towards the plateau of productivity, as they call it. And I believe that's true. I think because you can buy a computer for less than $800 that will run a very believable virtual environment, because people are getting used to using them in gaming technology, etc., there's been enough of a technology sea change and enough of a cultural sea change that we can finally start harnessing this technology and using it for practical applications. And I'll give you a few examples today. I think I'll speed through this. This is sort of the history of virtual reality has been around for a long time. Back in the early 60s and 70s, people were using it in the military arena with head-mounted displays, but there wasn't a general-purpose virtual reality system. And then we went through the 80s of these expensive, heavy head-mounted displays for virtual reality. So now we're at the point where the technology is possible. So why would you use a virtual environment for a cognitive therapy or for physical therapy or some of the areas that you can use it in? Well, Yvonne and I right now have a company that's using virtual reality technology for behavioral medicine. Why do we use the technology to do that? Well, we find that it improves the therapeutic process by engaging the users. It can overcome barriers. Maybe people are hesitant to do something because of the pain involved or because of the concept of stress that's associated with it. It allows you to harness telemedicine technology to extend your clinical reach. Because we're using a synthetic environment with known variables, we can start doing some quantitative analysis as well as qualitative work. And we start folding in some standard assessment tools and enhanced, we can come up with clinical reports. Okay. All right, well, I'm going to turn it over to Ivana to talk about one example of how virtual reality technology has been harnessed to do cognitive therapy. And then I'll push on to, after that, to talk about physical therapy.
So when we look at virtual reality and more of the behavioral medicine, and we started talking about failure. One thing that virtual reality gives us and the technology that we are developing is a practice ground that is safe for the participants to use. A lot of the time for changing behavior or creating new behaviors, we need a practice ground. The only way we have right now is I'm going to take my client or patient into my office. We're going to sit next to each other or opposite to each other, and I will tell them what they should imagine, and they will try, and we're going to go on like that. This is kind of the best we have for right now. Is it effective? Well, we probably all know the data and have some experience with that. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. But it is somewhat limited. It really relies on me being able to convince you to kind of go on with me on this experiment, and you having the imagination and the capacity available to you to imagine and try things inside of your mind. No matter what that is, be it an alternative behavior, alternating patterns when it comes to abuse, substance abuse, verbal or domestic abuse, any behavior that you want to change, or any other thing that you in your lifestyle would like to change. If you get a new diagnosis as a diabetes and you need to change your lifestyle patterns, all these we just sort of try out in our imaginations. What virtual reality will give us is that we can try these in virtual worlds where we have the capacity to practice without sort of a risk for us, but also we practice while engaging all of our senses. It's a lived experience that we give each other. So some of the some of the disciplines where we are pioneering virtual reality would be phobias and anxieties. It's pretty straightforward. If I'm really afraid of spiders, I can go to my therapist, and if I am that dedicated of a therapist, I can bring the box of spiders and try it. I think both me and the patient would run, from the office very quickly. Or I can go into the virtual environment, have a spider virtually, and kind of try that out in, safe environment. That is somewhat funny. If we start thinking about PTSD, and we start thinking about some of the combat-related PTSD. If I'm a soldier, I'm returning from a war zone, and some of these things are still within my system and set me off, I do not want to go back there. It is probably contraindicated for me to go back there. But if I can do it inside a virtual world, that is a different kind of story. I can very gradually, slowly come to terms with the triggers that are setting up the anxious or stressful behaviors for me, and I can work on it at my pace and at the safety of the therapist's office versus the combat zone. If I have developmental disabilities and I have hard time reading, writing, or recognizing social cues, in the virtual environment, we can kind of tailor it to the disability that they're the existing disability. So you have sort of a gradual steps of recognizing faces, understanding, oh, this is really anger, and this is probably not a good idea to kind of keep going, or this is just, being shy, or this is being happy or excited. Now, we're also trying the technology with conduct disorders, with kids, mostly with kids and adolescents that have hard times regulating their own behavior. They kind of rush in. We all have that experience from our youth of kind of rushing in and kind of going, oops. Well, in their case, the oops leads them to usually a juvenile hall or some correctional facility. And this technology gives them an opportunity to rehearse and have their, skyrocketing behavior go forward in a safe zone. And then having a therapist look through that wisdom and kind of go, okay, well, here, see what happened. Well, if this was a real world, what do you think the consequences would be? Or see what the consequences are. Now, let's see what can we do and what can we teach you so you don't get that far that fast. Drug and alcohol abuse, we are really looking into developing some of these for people with addictions, because we can really say, okay, well, you've been in therapy with me for 3 months, I think it's time for you to go to a party and try and see how you do. Or go back to your shooting alley and let's see if you can resist the temptation. Probably not a good idea. Highly unethical. But the reality of everyday life is it will happen. You will have the temptation. Maybe it's just going to be in the form of the Safeway aisle with all the wines and drinks, but it will happen. And this way we can prepare ourselves for it in a little different and more realistic form. So there's some more examples that we are trying: eating disorders, impulsive disorders, learning disabilities, and some of the neurocognitive disorders as well. A lot of the development has been moving forward through the military and their use of virtual reality. There is, right now, two of the major virtual reality systems out there that the military is using. One is called Virtual Iraq, and it uses a sort of the what I call the roller coaster ride virtual reality system. It's used for PTSD. You have the head-mounted display. It's sort of a standalone system. And the therapist takes you sort of on a ride through a certain scenarios and can make them happen, explode bombs and all kinds of combat-related events in the hopes that it will trigger some of the symptoms from the soldier, but in the safety of that office, and they will work through some of the reaction that the soldier will have. Now, what Walter and I are working on is a different system. It's an avatar-based system. It's a virtual reality system that is an online application where you kind of assume a role of one of the avatars. Now, you meet inside a virtual world. That virtual world depends on what we design. So you can meet while you're in Iraq in a little house in the suburbs with your family, because anybody that has a laptop, sort of a standard $800 laptop and internet connection, can actually log into those worlds and interact. Obviously, those technologies are used not only for therapeutic, but also for social and modeling and purposes for the military. You can model behaviors. You can arrange troops to actually work together. So simulation and other technologies as well. We do have an example. Mm-hmm. That one. And we just it's a longer video, but we're going to just show you a little quick clip just to kind of give you an idea.
Behind me and around me here are real people that are all networked around the U.S. here into the virtual world. And I'm going to turn around and introduce a couple of those to you.
So this is voice over IP.
Hello, Dr. Reed, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm good. How are you, sir?
Very well. Where are you from?
I am in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
You can tell who's talking because their little cloud here makes that little squiggly line.
I'm coming to you from Central Florida.
Excellent. Amir?
I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California.
Outstanding, Amir. Great. And hey, guys. Isa?
Hi. I'm coming to you from Saskatchewan, Canada.
And Bola?
I am here from sunny Chicago, Illinois.
Well, great, guys. So you can see that we have a host of teams
the Jaffe House.
Hey, listen, guys, I've got a special treat for you guys today. You know, we've created a virtual environment that we can go to, and you come to and see Baghdad, where I work. Would you guys like to do that?
Yeah,
Jerry. Yeah,
we did
one that
we had real guns.
Would be remember, don't touch anything.
So contrary to the mom's comment, they can pretty much touch everything. And here you can see the family.
We'll let y'all gather around behind me here, and then we'll have the lieutenant come up. Hey, Junior, get over here, Junior.
So you can see that, the technology has all kinds of possibilities. We are actually working on a program like that for the military that would connect their families, especially when they're deployed for a very long time. It takes a lot of stress and later on, manifests as all kinds of trouble. Now, Walter's company, InWorld, is a company that is creating, and it is so far the only, apart from Second Life, that is trying to do similar type of work, avatar-based virtual reality platform. As Walter said, one of the, or few of the really important features is it's voiceover IP, so all that you really need is a mouse, computer, and a headset, headphones and headset. You talk normally, and you interact inside that virtual world through the avatars that you create. You know, the use of the technology is probably far-reaching. Some of it we know already. Some of it we're guessing sort of ahead. There is a lot of things that you can do. You can also do, apart from clinical work, you can do a lot of supervision and all kinds of therapy through this. You can do it locally, so you can have the two people inside in the same office next to each other, or you can be on different sides of the globe. You can also talk to each of the people that you have inside the virtual world individually and also as a group. So if I need to kind of tap somebody anonymously on the shoulder, and no one else, I don't want anybody else to hear about it, I have that capacity as well. And that is a very useful thing for training and supervision. If you're training new doctors or new therapists, you don't want to embarrass them in front of everybody, or it's really not good for the therapeutic environment, you have the capacity to do it sort of alone. So you can see that we have a lot of different worlds. You can be in the classroom, you can be in the plane, so you can address some of the fear of flying, or you know, some of the PTSD, or in the house, in the city. I mean, pretty much the designer and the is the limit. I mean, if I say that I want, you know, medieval castle, I can probably have it. One of the thing is, there's a funny thing that happens. Obviously, you have avatars that you make. We have children avatars and adult, male, female. You can design the avatars to your liking. So there is there's a limit to that, but you have a pretty sophisticated way of creating it as close to your liking as you can. It seems to engage us sort of faster and deeper than our face-to-face interaction, especially in a certain modalities. We're not quite sure why that is, but it seems that for some reason that face-to-face contact for certain issues, and especially for certain therapeutic issues, is far too complicated and complex and probably threatening. And this gives us somewhat easier way of communicating. So role play, which is one of the staples of therapy, where I say, well, let's imagine that, it takes on a whole different meaning. And instead of a role play, it's really a trying out. So there's a lot of clinical applications for this kind of technology that we already talked about. Some of the other advantages, it's you can record all your action inside a virtual world, but one particularity of that is that you can record it from any perspective and you can switch that perspective. So if I, for example, have an exchange with you and want to know what it was like for you to listen to me, I can become you in the virtual world by a few clicks of a button and actually see and hear myself talk at you, and see what it was like, how effective I was, how much did I stutter, oh, how terrible did it feel. I know what I felt, but I have no idea what it looked like from your vantage point. That's something that in real life we can only imagine, but we cannot try. Here you can. Again, it has. We have the in-ear coaching. That's that capacity to talk to individual members. Remote access. There are plenty of places where we can really be, but this kind of gives us a capacity to meet anyway, and it is a little easier than just the video. If you have video conferencing, it's great, it's better than nothing, but you are limited at seeing that face, and that's it. You can do things together apart from talking. Here, you can. You can model interactions that are difficult. So if I'm going to a hospital and I'm really nervous or I really need to ask pertinent questions about my medical condition, I can try it out. But if I also want to log into a system that gives me some kind of support or help anonymously because I don't really want to be known or I'm not comfortable yet, that gives me that option as well. And that's a big advantage. And that is your slide.
Great. Well, why don't we pause for a second? This talk's going to be in three different settings. We've talked a little bit about the VR technology. We've talked a little bit about one particular platform and how it's deployed for cognitive issues. I'm going to talk about physical therapy, occupational therapy, and then I'm going to say, all right, what about disabilities? Why hasn't this technology yet been dramatically applied to disability solutions as it has been in the other areas? Before we push on to the other two segments, though, why don't we ask Ivana some questions about the cognitive stuff? I want to start out with one question about you mentioned cognitive issues involving children with learning disabilities. I know you've done a social skill group with someone with Asperger's. Can you describe how the technology was useful for them overcoming some of their barriers?
The biggest example for that would be that for most of the children, their self-awareness is always derived from somebody else. So their sense of control and power is somewhat limited in the social interactions. Now, what the social skills group does is it creates, it gives them the knowledge and sort of the steps of how successful interaction looks like. And then they are able to practice it inside the virtual environment. Now, why would that be better than practicing it live with real people? Well, number one, it's less threatening. Number two, you can slow it down into incremental little steps that it would be really almost impossible to do in a real interaction with real people. You can record it and come back to it and really kind of pick it apart and make it so they understand where is the step that they don't see. For a lot of these children, they have no idea what happened. All of a sudden, they're in a situation that went way too far and they don't know what happened. What this technology gives them is it slows the process and magnifies each tiny little step so they can understand it and they can practice until they, as we say, grok it, until they really get it and they can move on. And it makes it far easier than if we did it live. And
any other questions about the cognitive aspects of VR for therapy?
I'm just curious, maybe probably because a lot of the terminology is overused.
Sure.
When you talk about children with behavioral disorders, are we talking about sort of a medical, clinical diagnosis, or are we talking about kids who are in school with some bad things and now they're in the principal's office and now they're going through a program?
Both. I mean, I think this technology spans all the spectrum. So you can have children that are basically just behaviorally challenged, all the way to Asperger's or conduct disorders, where the challenge is a little bit more than just, you know, few misdemeanors, and then all the way to diagnosis, where you have people with serious medical diagnoses or behavioral diagnoses as anxiety, agoraphobia, you know, PTSD, and that kind of anger management or aggression. So it would span all of those.
And you've seen improvements
I mean, we are working on it, and this is really in a very early stages, so I would hesitate to say yes to everything. But it seems... Right. Right. Yes. I didn't know who else raised their hand, so you would just have to shoot out and ask a question, please. I think it's a really good question, and I think you start with, you know, it is our responsibility as bringing in new technology in to kind of shine a light on some of these issues. It doesn't look real. Well, the research actually shows that the more real you make it, the more your brain will fight you. So the fact that it is real enough. It just has to be good enough, as Winnicott said about the mothers. You just have to be good enough mother. Well, you just have to have good enough virtual environment. And your brain will, after a while, adjust to it and accept it. If you make it sort of photorealistic, you will start nitpicking and say, well, this is not quite right, and the concept will be lost.
Somebody will do what they call empty chair therapy, where they'll say, okay, let's do some role-playing. That last time you had an argument with your spouse, what were you thinking? Let's rehearse it. Or you might say, here's your mother that has been so mean to you for the last 20 years in this chair. I want you to say something to her that you should say. Well, looking at it from a neurobiological perspective, it's not going to work, because in order to change a system, which is what we're trying to do with behavioral therapy, you have to activate the system. And the brain isn't getting the visual stimulation, it's not getting the auditory stimulation, it's not getting the emotional stimulation if you're just using your memory. And if it's something painful, your memory doesn't want to go there. So you're right, it's not as ideal as it might be to do in vivo therapy with real people doing things, but it's better than in virtual therapy where they're just saying use your imagination. It's sort of halfway in between. And it takes them down, it works remarkably well. It's surprising, but people do buy into it. I think it's maybe all the time we're spending browsing on the internet now, we've learned to immerse ourselves cognitively in these two-dimensional worlds, and the 3D ones are even more believable.
Right. And so, taking it seriously, I think that really but it is really for us to explain what is behind that, and we all know that there are games that we can play that will create and give us tremendous things. And there are therapies that can be quite useless when it comes to producing.
If you're interested in this, I can point to some research for the phobias, for example. They can show dramatically improved desensitization and habituation of the phobic response that lasts longer than if you're just using your imagination to do the therapy. So, again, my bias is to look at it from a neurobiological perspective, which is we've got to activate the brain in order to change it. And the VR environments give us the scaffolding to do that a little bit easier than just imaginative therapy.
The VR gives you a lived experience. It's not just engaging far more of your systems than just.
Okay. I'm going to try and go through the rehab part a little fast. Please slow me down if I'm going too fast. How many of people here have actually had to go through physical therapy or occupational therapy? Okay, a handful of people. It's boring. It's really boring. You have to have the personality of an athlete to do it. And it's unless you're seeing dramatic progress, you wonder, why am I doing this? It's painful, and I'm not an athlete. Why am I having to do this? So one of the concepts of using VR environments for physical therapy and occupational therapy is that they're more functionally realistic. Instead of having people use, these are some standard tools that are used in occupational therapy, physical therapy. Here's some other examples of things that somebody might be doing. Like here, this woman's recovering from a stroke, and she has to put these rings on top of this plastic pillar. It's inane and boring. So one of the things that people have done using VR is hook up some of these devices to game environments and make it interesting, make it functional, so that instead of going like this, putting the ring on top of the pillar, maybe you're doing something as part of the job that you want to learn to do after an injury. And it's more motivational because you can do it with other people over the internet. It's more engaging because you can see your progress. So the VR environments give, in this case, again, scaffolding to help the person who's going through this arduous and difficult process of rehabilitation have it be more interesting than the standard analog rehabilitation. I'm going to skip through this to save some more time for some of the other areas. Much like in cognitive rehab, with stroke rehab, traumatic brain injury rehab, neuro rehab, the VR environments give you the ability to make it more functional than the standard rehabilitation. You can objectively index improvement because you can break it down into smaller steps. You can staircase progress, which is important for a neuro rehab. And you can close the feedback loop by giving the patient feedback on how they're making their progress rather than just having an analog system, which really doesn't give you that information. Also, this is important, we can be patient by providing computer-assisted rehabilitation. In standard rehabilitation, you often need to have a clinician there working with you, and that's expensive. But if we switch it over to the computer to help guide you through the rehabilitation, we can magnify the number of patients that clinician can see. All right, I'll quickly show you some exciting data that's been coming out of this field. This is a study that was done, I think, probably 10 years ago, but it was pioneering and has been replicated since by Maureen Holden. And her group put three space sensors on the elbow and the wrist to measure movement of the upper extremity. They took people who were more than 10 years post-stroke, so they plateaued in their therapy, and they gave them some feedback on how to do a task. In this case, they had a simulation where they were trying to learn to pour a glass of water from a glass into a hole. And they captured the data, and this is just some examples of three different individuals, the trajectory and the amount of stability in their ballistic movements. They mapped it out in a three-dimensional graph. And you can see for these three individuals, just direct comparisons. Again, these were people who had plateaued. They thought they weren't going to be able to make any further improvements. They did make improvements when they had the patient feedback and the guidance that the virtual environment gave them. There's a lot of groups, and again, these are mostly in laboratories. Unfortunately, they're not out yet as commercial products. And I can show you some videos of these later after my talk if you're interested, where they're taking some low-cost three-space and force sensors and hooking them up to the upper extremity, to the ankles, and people do these tasks. Like here, they're steering this airplane through a window as they're flying along and trying to avoid the mountains. Again, it's engaging cognitively, getting them to exercise and do something that otherwise they might not be patient enough to do. We did a pilot study with the hand clinic here at Stanford where we hooked up a system with a server. We sent patients home with hand therapy tools, and we hooked up the clinician with the ability to manage the patient's progress remotely. We went to East Palo Alto, we went to Los Altos, we went all over the Bay Area, and we did an ABA type of study where the people going through therapy would use our system for 2 weeks with the virtual environment. Then they would use it for 2 weeks without. Then they would go back on for 2 weeks, and vice versa for the other group, which was BAB. We had a big problem doing the study because we would go to pick up the equipment from the group that was using it for the therapy, and they wouldn't give it back. They said, this is helping me, my hand get better. I need it in order to fully recover. So we learned from that study, and it also showed us how important it is for right now what typically happens with home rehabilitation. People get sent home with a Xerox sheet of paper, some exercises they're supposed to do, and the clinician doesn't see them until 2 or 3 weeks later, and if they've been overdoing or underdoing or doing their exercise incorrectly, they don't get to see it. So this is technology that can close that feedback loop. Here's the user interface that we developed for this. We gave the patients some feedback on their progress. There was a video they could see on how to do their exercises. The clinician could give them a little video clip saying you're making a lot of progress. And we could have games that they could play with other people who were going through the same rehab. In this case, it was swimming with a school of fish, to motivate them by being part of a group going through the process. We talked about the cognitive stuff here. Okay, here's some new things. This is a project that we're hoping to do with the U.S. Army to help individuals with amputations. And the Army is curious, how will virtual world help people who are adjusting to an amputation get comfortable with their amputation? They have some things to learn in terms of their new prosthetic, and they also need to build a community. So by using the virtual environment and placing people in these virtual environments, let's see if I can get to the example here. Oh, I don't have the picture here, I'm sorry. The idea is that they can connect with other people with the same injury or dealing with the same problems, connect to family members and friends. And it's a question, what's the value of using the virtual environment to help them learn to deal with their new disability? Again, it's more of a research project at this point. Let's see. Dave, how are we doing on time? Okay, good, good. One of the things that's come up recently is with the Wii system, with a lot of games attached to it. There's been a lot of clinicians are starting to use the Wii for rehabilitation purposes. Now, it's a problem, and I'll tell you why it's a problem. It's not managed rehabilitation. They'll send someone home with the device saying, I want to get your upper extremity moving. Play these games. They end up causing a lot of injuries because it's not a managed rehabilitation process. Now, I think the Wii has great potential as a three-space sensing device and visual feedback device, but I think you need to have a layer of software on top of it that allows the clinician to see what you're doing, measure your progress, give you feedback, and adjust the protocol, make sure you're not overdoing or underdoing it. It's possible to do the exercises the wrong way and injure yourself even worse. And that's what's happening right now. And it's because the engineering and the design and the bringing the products to market just hasn't happened yet in this area. People would rather use a sophisticated clinical system to do rehabilitation at home, but nobody's really brought it out. And that's one of the questions I want to get to as we get to the end of the talk, is what are the barriers economically and business model-wise for getting these systems out? Why isn't this technology being used more commonly? Why is it only in the research labs? Here's some examples of some other things being used for to come. You might say it's the cost of the sensors is the problem. How can we measure movement in an inexpensive way? But there's lots of low-cost sensors out there. Again, I brought a whole parcel of videos I could show after I give my spiel. But here's a guy at Skip Rizzo's lab who just put some colored markers on some visual systems, and they've come up with some way of tracking the hands in 3D space and with a standard web camera. And they do some exercises here, and they have the software to manage the exercises. So it doesn't have to be expensive to measure the movement of the upper extremity. The hard part is just the business model, but I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. Here's another example of interfacing a low-cost force feedback system, the Falcon, to a gaming system. Again, you can get nice haptic feedback. It's not that expensive, but there aren't products out there yet that really take advantage of this. There are some expensive products that are out there that people buy for some gate labs and other facilities. This is a MoTeC system. I think it's in the $50,000 range, where they have a motion capture system and a VR environment to stimulate the person to do it. And those, again, end up being at very sophisticated facilities. Hasn't really migrated out to the small private practice market. Okay. Before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about what is going on with disability solutions. There are a handful of laboratories out there that are looking at VR and using it as an augmentative system or a solution for different types of disability problems. But again, nothing has come out commercially. There's user interest in this. There's half a dozen groups of people with disabilities that have found themselves on Second Life, and they use the virtual environment there as a place to meet and do some things that they otherwise might not be able to do in the non-virtual world. But between those two extremes, there's nothing in the middle. And my sense is that it's the problem that you've probably heard from the other people who've come to speak to this class, which is that you need to come up with the right business model to do it. And it's hard to find the right pathway to find reimbursement. It's hard to find the right pathway to have these systems paid for. And so people don't go there. They go to some of the other markets where it's an easier path to market. I also think there's a lack of clear thinking about how a virtual environment would be used for someone with disabilities. I was looking back at some of the papers that had been published at those conferences that we had back in the 90s on VR and disabilities. And people said, oh, the virtual environment will be fantastic as an interface for someone who is mobility impaired and can't participate in the same way. So we'll just make a virtual environment and they can use that to interact with other people. And I think there was a lot of fuzzy thinking going behind the value of that as a user interface. I think some of the things that have evolved over time is a better thinking about what's the proper use of augmentative technology in a virtual environment. But again, that step of taking it out to commercialize hasn't happened yet. Dave, what about your experience with coming up with a VR system for measuring gait? Has anybody expressed an interest in commercializing that, and how would you translate that?
Well, I have a colleague at Northwestern who's continuing to use that system, but it's still in research right now. So it's not commercial, and it's not clear that it would have enough force behind it to become a commercial system.
I think that's the real problem here is the business model behind these technologies and getting it out to the world. And I'll be honest with you, we haven't solved that from our end as a commercial company yet. The reason Yvonne and I are working on cognitive therapy is because it's cheaper. You can you don't have to worry about measuring the movement of the body, the position of the body, if you're just doing things that involve cognitive therapy. That's our shortcut. We very much would like to get to neural rehab, do some things for traumatic brain injury, do some things for stroke rehabilitation, and we view that as an adjacent area. But until we can show some success in the cognitive rehabilitation, it's going to be hard to justify the cost of the sensors, et cetera, for the physical therapy and occupational therapy markets. Okay. Why don't we pause for some questions, and if you'd like, then I could show some of the videos of some of the virtual environments and how they've been used.
I'll start it off.
Okay.
We've seen some head-mounted displays, and we've seen some people at screens. What are the advantages and disadvantages of using a head-mounted display versus a regular screen?
Well, I personally think the reason people use head-mounted displays is they said, let's throw everything at the problem. So back in the early 90s, when people were seeing, can we get an effect? They would get a $300,000 virtual reality system. They would get a $2,000 head-mounted display, and they would try and see, can we get results using this? But nobody's gone back to really do the study saying, how immersive do we have to be in order to get results? And we use the flat screens, and we're getting good results. I think it's the nature of the problem we're dealing with as part of it. I think we would use a head-mounted display for some of the more, neurological issues. Maybe during dealing with more with things like post-traumatic stress, the more immersive environment might be superior because you're engaging more parts of the visual system and the auditory system. But I'm more on the other side of, instead of saying prove to me that I can get away with without a head-mounted display, I'm more on the side of why don't we find out if we can't do what we tried to do without the head-mounted display. And so far we've had very positive results from all the people that we've tested our equipment with.
I mean, there's some preliminary research that actually shows that there's not a huge difference between if the monitor is large enough and the environment is not disruptive around you, that there's not a big difference between head-mounted display and flat-screen display. However, As Walter says, there are clinical advantages of the head-mounted displays. PTSD would be one of them, where the immersion seems to be far deeper. It maybe it's just a placebo effect, but we need to study that more if you do have that head-mounted display.
And I think the big change is now we have virtual environments that can be very realistic and very engaging because they react quickly. Before, if you had something with a long lag where the avatars looked like little wooden people and were square-shaped and they jerked around, you needed everything to make you feel like you're really there. But now we have some have any of you played some of the online games where, mostly they're shoot-em-up games? But what's your experience? They're very...
It's just amazing how immersed you can become.
Yeah.
I almost felt like I had post-traumatic stress.
Yeah. 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 And you have as many lives as you want, too. Yeah. Yeah. No, they're amazingly, and I don't think anybody knows why the current generation of virtual environments seems to be more immersive. Is it the speed of the processors? Is it the quality of the graphics? Is it the better 3D sound? There's some better heuristics of how things move and the gravity? I don't think we know, but we're getting good effects with the flat screen.
You really were reacting to that as if, wow, Yeah. And it was amazing that I would get that sensation through my hand versus through the rest of my body.
Well, there is a somatosynthesis, where your brain starts mapping some of the clues that correspond to what you think is going on. So vibration becomes more than just vibration.
And I just to add to that, Alex, also, one of the things you were talking about, the business model, to me, it looks like what's happening, you showed the hype cycle of technology.
Right.
And what's happening is there's a convergence that is going on with a lot of technology. And it almost seems like you're somewhat aptly placed, I would think, between things like Second Life, social media, social networking, you know, sort of like the Facebook next level, as well as gaming. Almost would seem like if you almost put aside the fact that you're doing this therapeutic and you were thinking, how could I take that existing technology to the next level? Like you're kind of there. And that could be your funding mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as you're improving that, you could work with them to say, in addition to that, I want you, we're going to build this. We're going to, you know, we can do both. But I remember taking a balloon ride many years ago, and the gentleman who took me up was describing how much he loved being alone in the balloon. And I said to him, well, geez, since that's such a part of your experience, why are you hauling all of us around in your room? And he says, so that I could pay for this place to do what I really wanted to do.
Right.
So it's almost like your business model is, well, let me partner with people to do some things so I can go do the things I really want to do.
Yeah. I think that is our schema right now, is to find a beachhead. And right now our beachhead is post-traumatic stress and social skills training for children with autism and Asperger's, and from there we'll go out. But like I said, it's been a 20-year quest for us to try and bring this technology to people with disabilities, and we're not there yet. And I have to go backwards in order to move forwards, but that seems to be where it is. Now I'd like to ask this group some questions that have been posed to me. I was at a grant review for Skip Rizzo's lab down in Southern California. Skip does a lot of the physical therapy work and a lot of the post-traumatic work as a research scientist. And one of the other panel members on the review panel was head of disability programs for the city of L.A. And he said, wouldn't virtual environments be a great thing for people with disabilities to be able to meet each other in a virtual environment instead of having to go out and you know, physically go to these different spots? And I wasn't sure how best to answer him. Yes, we can do that. It's a great way for people who don't want to get out of the house or have trouble getting out of the house to meet each other. But, the Dean came in wheelchair example of you can spend a lot of money on technology, but unless you really understand where it's needed, you can spend a lot of money to accomplish something that's not very useful. So I was curious, with your thinking, you've been thinking now through this course about technology and disabilities, where do you see the application of virtual reality technology to this market? We can measure things, we can put people at different places, we can slow things down, speed them up. Where does it map to your thinking about disability solutions?
I think the internet is sort of a virtual world in itself. So if people do a lot of texting and stuff and meeting in a text version of a virtual world, perhaps this is having a Second Life type of situation is just an extension of that.
Mm-hmm. So, but we're not really adding any additional capacities that way. One of the things I thought is for someone who's maybe learning to use a new adaptive device, it might be a good training medium. For example, my understanding is that children who are eligible for powered wheelchairs, they've often just been very passive for a lot of their life. They've been wheeled around by their parents, etc. And then there's a point where they need to start learning to navigate on their own if they get a powered wheelchair. A virtual environment might be a safe stepping stone for them to make that transition from being passive in terms of navigating into being active. But see, again, that's more of a therapeutic application.
It's training.
Yeah. I still haven't found good examples of how it's useful as a adaptive technology.
I just want to say it's 5:30, so anybody who has to leave is welcome to do so. If you have want to
to stick around for a few minutes. Walter will be here, and I'll be here, and look forward to seeing you on Thursday if you need to leave right now.
Okay.
But I think right now we should give a hand to Walter.
Thank you.
So if you have some further, going to further discussion or show some additional slides and pictures, this would be the time. I'm not sure if there's, I don't think there's another class in here afterwards, so you can stick around with it. But I want to thank everybody for attending as well.
Yeah. And we're located in Palo Alto, so if anybody's interested in a project, we could use your help.
Maybe you can suggest a project for the class next year.
Okay. All right. Great.
University of Oregon, this is before Darren was using a power chair. One of the concerns we had was, you know, once you put in a power chair, she's never, if you're not really mobile and moving and bumping into things, is that whole concept. And they had some early systems they were trying to develop for wheelchair use.
Right.
Virtually maneuver.
Yeah, Dean Inman was.
Yes, Dean Inman. That's what it was. So we had talked a couple times and really didn't get too far. But I actually think, just a minute, my bet feeling is that, if I were you guys, I would be talking on Facebook, and I would be saying...